training simulations are helping the Defense Department save money and maintain readiness at the same time. Sequestration's extension into fiscal 2014 may mean more simulators instead of live training. Sharon Pickup is Director of Defense Capabilities and Management Issues at the Government Accountability Office. She is looking at the cost benefits of training simulators for the Army and Marine Corps and how to decide when to use them. Sharon, it's always good to have you on the program. What specifically were you looking at here? The House wanted you to do this for the as part of the National Defense Authorization Act for 2012.
That's correct, Francis. And what we looked at is we looked at the extent to which the Army and Marine Corps have used and are increasing their use of simulation-based training over the past several years. And then we also looked to what extent they had information that would help them make decisions on when to use live or simulation-based training, as well as what the cost and performance benefits of using simulation-based training is.
Now, you write, the aviation communities in both services have used simulators to train service members on tasks such as takeoffs and emergency procedures that can't be taught safely live. But simulators are used a lot more commonly than just flight simulations now, aren't they?
That's correct. I mean, the aviation community is probably a little bit more out in front than, say, the ground force community is, and that is a function of technology and other factors. But I think since 2000, with the ongoing operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, that the Army and the Marine Corps have found more applications for simulated training, such as in being able to practice safety in vehicles and other aspects.
Now, you're writing about something here that I thought was particularly interesting, having followed the simulation concept for a while. This is a blurring of the line, as it were. You write, the services are also taking steps to better integrate live and simulation-based training, developing technical capabilities to connect previously incompatible simulation-based training devices. How is that working?
Mm-hmm. So, for example, we not only have we looked at the Army and Marine Corps, but we've also looked at the Navy and Air Force over the past couple of years as well. So, for example, in the Navy, they have a network in which they can connect up their simulated training across different platforms like ships, submarines, and aircraft. And so even though the units might be separated by hundreds of miles, they can train as though they were operating in close proximity to one another. And just one other example, the Air Force has a similar network, and for large-scale exercises, they can on a case-by-case basis for exercises, connect up these networks so that they, too, can have units trained together.
Now, you write that these the both branches, and I'm paraphrasing mm-hmm. here, they have subject matter experts who check out their programs, and they also go back afterwards and do evaluations of how effective the trainings were. But you write, neither service has established outcome metrics to assist them in more precisely measuring the impact of using simulation-based devices to improve performance or proficiency. Is that something that would be difficult for them to do you think, or is this just something they haven't gotten around to yet?
Well, I think no matter what the program is, developing metrics can be challenging. And certainly in the case of simulation-based training, there's a lot of variables that the services would have to take into account. But both the services have identified benefits that they think that they gain from simulators, but it's primarily based on anecdotal information, based on commanders' assessments of service members' proficiencies. But in terms of actual metrics, the metrics that they have tend to be more quantitative, such as the number of soldiers or Marines who use a simulator, or the number of, for example, in the case of ammunition, the number of rounds fired, or in the case of vehicles, the number of miles driven. But neither of the services can tell you how much is enough. In other words, how many at what point in time, in terms of number of hours or number of rounds fired or miles driven, does a service member gain a certain level of proficiency? And so that's why we recommended that they need to develop some more outcome-oriented metrics to help them actually determine the benefits of using simulation-based training.
Sharon Pickup of the Government Accountability Office, the report that we're talking about will be linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. And that's one area, Sharon, where you made a recommendation about a metric. Another one is the cost metric. And you're right, the Army and Marine Corps officials also generally consider simulation-based training to be less costly than live training. And you talk about some of the data that they look at to make that argument, but there's a deficiency there as well, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm. Well, our report is not saying that either service does not have cost information. They do have information on certain costs associated with training in a live environment and training in a simulated environment, but they haven't identified which costs that they need to use to compare apples to apples, so to speak, so that they can determine the best mix of live and simulated training. And some of the examples of that would be on the side of the simulation, like what the cost of contractors to operate the simulators might be, or what the cost of fuel might be in the live training compared to the cost of technicians and spare parts needed to maintain simulators.
Now, the conversation, as I mentioned at the beginning, will probably get more heated within DOD as the money for training shrinks, especially if we get another round of sequestration. Do you have recommendations about what kinds of methodologies they should implement, or just that they should do it in order to be able to ascertain this information?
Mm-hmm. So we don't necessarily make a recommendation about, for example, what the best metric is or what the best cost methodology is, and we're certainly not suggesting that in the case of cost, for example, that they have to identify every single cost associated with both types of training, but we are saying that they should identify at least the minimal types of costs that they should consider so that they can make an informed decision on how best to use simulated training, and so that they know the cost implications, particularly in this fiscally constrained environment.
Another thing that you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, Sharon, is that you looked at the same issues in the Navy and the Air Force. In this report with the Army and Marine Corps, how does that compare to what you saw with the other two branches?
Mm-hmm. So we saw a similar situation in the Air Force in terms of the cost methodology, for example. I mean, that they had estimated that they could save a certain amount of money by reducing live training and using more simulation based, but they hadn't really gathered the information and undertaken the analysis that they needed to actually substantiate the dollar savings. And so that was one, you know, similarity in the Air Force. In the case of the Navy, for example, in the area of metrics, they were probably further along than the Army and the Marine Corps on the aviation side, for example, in terms of actually identifying which training could be done with simulation and what exactly needed to be done to certify training based on using simulation. So they actually had probably a better set of metrics.
Sharon, thanks very much for the comparison and the information. It's great to have you back on the program.
Thank you, Francis.
Sharon Pickup is Director of Defense Capabilities and Management Issues, the Government Accountability Office.